In an ancient temple on an island off the coast of Korea, the poet Koen is giving a poetry reading. Long ago, Koen was a monk here, seeking peace after experiencing firsthand the trauma of the Korean War, and with its painted wooden buildings offset by the rich autumn colours of the surrounding trees, Jeongdongsa Monastery is a place of serenity, discipline and contemplation. I'm Mike Greenwood, and in this programme I'll be exploring the extraordinary life and work of monk, activist and poet Koen, the people's poet of Korea. Now in his 80th year, Koen has become a national figure in Korea. Once a thorn in the side of authority, he's been nominated for the Nobel Prize, and he's recognised by his peers as a poet of global stature. He gives voice to the rich culture and frequently tragic history of Korea, and yet he speaks of truths and experiences that are vividly universal. His is a voice that deserves to be heard.
Ruins. When I was just 20, everywhere I went was in ruins. During the nights of curfew, wide awake, I often inclined more to death than to life. Ruins didn't easily change into something. They didn't change into something and weren't born to cry as other babies. The war did not end in my heart. 50 years later, I saw the ruins in this city. I was still a piece of broken brick in the ruins, in this ostentatious city.
The oil lamp lights of those days are gone now, but the post-ruin age has not reached me.
Internationally, Koen's work is attracting a growing readership. Former poet laureate Sir Andrew Motion admires the way his poems fuse the inner voice with that of a witness to his times.
He has led a life, a human life, and a poetic life of quite extraordinary interest. And in the coincidence of his life with a period of amazing change in Korean history, it is possible to say that he sort of embodies modern Korea, both where South Korea has come to, but he also embodies the sufferings that it's had to undergo in order to get there. Indeed, the poem Ruins is a poem which picks up on the devastations of the earlier part of the century and then compares it to different kinds of ruination now, both the ruination of unbuilt things now and also the spoiling of ancient culture, perhaps as industrialization and so on have sort of rocketed South Korea to the place that it is in now. What you submit to when you get interested in reading Koen is you go and stand in a river and the torrent of this stuff just pours over you.
People talk of the miracle of the Han River, that resurgence of Korea and the building boom that's transformed a war-ravaged capital into one of the major cities of the world. We've taken a train to Suwon, home of Koen, once a city ringed by an elegant stone wall, now swallowed in the conurbation emanating from Seoul.
60% of the Seoul landscape is hills.
My travelling companion is Brother Anthony of the Teze community. A monk from Cornwall, he made Korea his home 40 years ago. An academic whose translations of Koen's work helped bring it to a world audience. Like Koen, he's witnessed South Korea's astonishing rate of change.
It was all rice fields, to even what is now Gangnam, you know, famous Gangnam style. When we arrived, there were still rice fields in Gangnam.
This is a very smart residential suburb across the river of Seoul.
Yes, very expensive, yes.
Koen, whom we're going to see, has both lived through that transformation. In his 80 years, he's seen the change from a landscape of rice fields and devastated cities to modern Seoul, modern Korea. He's also chronicled that change.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole of Korean society has been deeply transformed because, yes, when Koen was born and until after the Korean War, most people in Korea were living in farming villages. It's a total change in consumerism. And yes, and of course now every time they have a long weekend, hundreds of Koreans go to play golf in Thailand.
Ko Un's most ambitious work of poetry is Maninbo, or 10,000 Lives. It runs to many volumes of gritty, evocative poems that bring to life a cast of characters who've lived in interesting times, recording the history of Korea from the days of Ko Un's youth, when the country was a vassal state of Japan, the horrors of war with the communist North, then a series of dictatorships as South Korea rose from the ashes. It's still painful territory for many people. Maninbo weaves disparate lives together into a tapestry, a reminder of what's been lost.
우선 하늘의 밤 하늘의 별은 지금보다 훨씬 풍부했었다.
In the country where I was born, the sky was full of stars. And as a child, I thought they were grains of rice. The sky was rich, but we were poor. We didn't have enough to eat. We didn't have our own country at the time. It belonged to others. So when we harvested the rice, it was carried off over the sea for the Japanese.
In what other ways did the occupation of the Japanese affect life in Korea?
They took not just our rice, they took our names, our language. We're to speak Japanese, and were given Japanese names. And when your identity is taken away, all you have left is language.
Ko Un learnt his native language in secret from a farmhand, an early act of defiance. The occupier left, but then Korean fought Korean as war swept back and forth across the peninsula. It changed everything.
While super fortresses pound the enemy's factories and storehouses, his supply lines are given an almost continuous strafing by rocket-firing jets.
It was a terrible war. Several million people were killed in just a few years. And in the face of all that death, I could no longer think of the future. What I saw was that human beings hated each other. They killed each other. This cruelty, the noise of the war, was intolerable. So I poured acid in my ears to block it out.
You went further than trying to drown out the noises of the world. You've tried on a number of occasions to take your own life. What led you to do that?
I carried corpses in the war, carried death next to my skin. I was inhabited by death and felt a strong urge to follow the dead, the people of my childhood, into death. If you're born a yokel out in the backwoods, once you've reached 5 or 6, there's no time left for play. Forced to become a drudge following your father, with work piling up like the hills. When autumn comes, if mother tells you to bring home mother snails, you go rushing out to the rice paddy, foraging for snails half a day in the wide open spaces out there is great, really great. Expert snail catcher Byung-ok drank lye by mistake and died. None of the neighborhood kids know where he's buried. If a kid dies, there's no tomb, no offerings. There'll be another one born by and by.
In Korean culture, it's very important to mark death and to mark a tomb. You're describing a world in Maninbo which was erased completely. There was no marker, there was no relic left, except your poems.
Lamenting the dead is a strong theme in my poetry. From my earliest childhood, I saw so many people die, and you hear so much about death all over the world. Grieving for them is an essential basis for my poetry.
Well, he was actually a Zen monk, And he has always maintained that there is a Zen-like element in all good poetry.
I'm Mike Greenwood, and you're listening to Ko Un, the People's Poet of Korea, for BBC World Service. One of Ko Un's long-term advocates, even in times when it wasn't always politically expedient to be so, is Professor Paek Nuk Chung, a literary critic and publisher.
To go beyond words, through words, and also he has a very strong sense of social and historical reality and the writer's responsibility for that. All genuine poetic quest should include both a Zen-like element and a realistic element. And Ko Un's poetry does this in a sort of natural way. You know, while you're reading poems with great pleasure, you catch moments, a flash of Zen-like insight.
So what you end up with is something which is at once linear, because it feels endless, this flow of poems, and at the same time, oddly, and again rather paradoxically, circular, because a lot of the philosophical elements in the poems are to do with that, are to do with endings being in beginnings, and with renewals, and the cyclical nature of time and of life.
Simply, we are each going our own way. But we say it's because someone told us to. The water simply flows down the hills, but we say it's because someone told it to. Human wisdom's pitiful stuff.
After the war, South Korea struggled to forge a future for itself as a modern economy. But the price of progress was a series of corrupt and increasingly brutal military dictatorships. Ko Un left his monastery. Instead of Zen-like oblivion, he sought dissolution in drink. But chance has always played a role in his life. It was by chance that he was saved from a couple of suicide attempts. Then, one morning, he woke from a drunken stupor on a bar table. In the litter at his feet was a newspaper article about a textile worker who'd set himself alight as an act of protest at repressive conditions. For Ko Un, it was a turning point.
정말 나는 이 지금도 나는 우연이라는 말처럼 매혹적인 말이 어디가 있을까 생각한다.
Chance is an important word for me. Chance is also destiny. That worker's death made me think no longer of my own death, but of death in society. This led me into action.
다시 태어난 것이죠.
But you had this moment of waking up in the litter of a bar, and you had this spiritual or political awakening as well, and you decided that poetry wasn't just going to be about drinking, it was going to be about history. Poetry is history, history is poetry, you said.
There was a time when I thought literature and history were the same thing. But it's not just history. It's also dreams. Literature has to engage with the society. I thought my writing could help bring Korea out from the dark dictatorship. I wanted poetry to change the world.
He never wavered about his conviction that his poems can deliver messages to the people and soothe the, you know, hurt feelings of people.
Ko Un committed himself to the pro-democracy movement and took to the streets in protest against the government with a generation of college activists for whom he became a leading spokesman. Yang Sung-jin, now an editor at the Korea Herald, was there.
Ko Un was kind of a symbolic figure because he was really passionate about, you know, politics and the reconciliation with North Korea. So we recognized him as a kind of compatriot or fellow fighter. And he wasn't just talking about it or writing about it. He was there. Whenever there was a major demonstrations, he was there and he was reading poems filled with emotions. So that moved a lot of people.
Ko Un's poems became part of the public soundtrack of political dissent. In 1980, the demonstrators got serious and the dictators got heavy. In the town of Kwangju, hundreds of students and townspeople were massacred. Ko Un was thrown into prison, tortured, Every day he expected execution. His response was a vow to write Maninbo, an epic commitment to write a poem for every person he'd ever met, a symbolic gesture in the face of the possibility of oblivion. It was also in prison that he wrote one of his best-known poems, Sunlight.
An honoured visitor is coming to my tiny cell with his north-facing window. It's not the chief making his rounds, but a gleam of sunlight for an instant late in the afternoon. A gleam no bigger than a square of folded pasteboard. I go crazy. It's first love. I hold out the palm of my hand, warm the toes of my shy bared feet. Then, as I prostrate myself on the floor and bask my gaunt, unreligious face in the scrap of sunlight, all too fleeting it slips away. When the visitor has receded beyond the iron bars, the room becomes several times colder and darker. One day it was a coffin. One day it was altogether the sea.
영화도 다 거기서 사람들 몇이 살아난 것.
How did you and why did you begin writing Maninbo?
I had protested and was put in a military prison. The cell was barely the size of this table. There was no window, no light. I thought they would shoot me and I would soon be dead. So I began to prepare myself. How would I die? What would be my last words? With no prospect of a future ahead, all I had was my memories. I began to remember when I was a child, all the people I had met when I was a monk. They started to come to me. And I made a promise that if I were ever free again, I would write about them all. That's what I focused on in the dark. And just that thought gave me the strength to endure prison. Great when the peddler. Springtime. In springtime, when the first sprouts appear in icy fields, the first visitor is unfailingly great when the peddler. The moment great when sets down his pack, all the neighborhood kids come swarming. All his odds and ends are dazzling. All the girls long to have a hairpin, a little mirror. The farm boys are eyeing a reel for the string of a kite. Yet, no matter how much great Wen hawks his wares, he finds it hard to eke out a living, for no one can pay for his goods, even with rice or barley. The peddler's rough beard bristles in complaint.
Maninbo is full of narratives compressed into poems, unexpected twists and vivid, earthy lives. Andrew Motion.
I thought, insofar as I thought about Korean poetry at all, that it probably was bound to share with Japanese and Chinese poetry a certain sort of aesthetic. Butterflies and trees and early morning mist and brevity and haikus and a kind of delicacy. But actually Korean poetry is a good deal more robust than that. It's much more feisty, it's more fun. And we see that very vividly in Cohen, I think, who again becomes a kind of emblem of his nation. But he doesn't want to serve up a book of poems that is kind of handily 60 pages long every 5 years. I mean, he writes, I should think by the look of it, poems every day. It's probably sometimes more than one poem a day.
His latest collection is 1,000 pages.
I'm not surprised to hear it. I mean, it's absolutely phenomenal.
Ko-un sees his role as part of an ancient tradition in Korea, that of a shaman, a conduit for voices and spirits from another reality. As he puts it, a public channel between one person's soul and another's.
When I was a child, when the moon rose, my father would go out into the yard barefoot and start dancing. And somehow, when I have a blank page in front of me, it is as if the words start dancing on it. So the words are not mine, but the person in the poem. The reason I bring back to the present people from the old days is to offer their blood, their tears, and their joy to people today, who live far away from each other and don't communicate, they don't share. In my childhood, despite our sorrows and pains, there was the beauty of being together. People today don't know how to communicate in joy and sorrow. Today people are so intent on living in the present, they find it hard to dream of something better, something nobler.
There's an emotional strain in Korean life, a nostalgia, a sorrowful yearning. They have a name for it, Han. Now that may be something of a cultural stereotype, but it finds a voice in Cohen's poems, looking at the passing of a career he's known. This is the district of Gangnam, immortalized recently in a global hit song, Gangnam Style. Once a sleepy suburb across the Han River, now a roaring, soaring center of consumerism and modern style. It's the kind of place that causes Cohen to reflect on what might be being lost, what he's called the glory of its pain in Korea's headlong striving for bigger, better material success.
Where has my frontier gone? It's wrong, wrong, wrong. All of the Korean peninsula is turning into Seoul, a country with a crush on glitz, on thousands of flashy events. You and I, all of us, ditto, are turning into New York, the place where once we knew sorrow, the place that was far from anywhere, the place we could not live, the place we finally left after being held back, the murder flat of my heart, the place where at sunset we could see clearly the biennial bloom of Queen's flowers. Where has my frontier gone?
Where the waters of the Han River flow into the Yellow Sea, here from the northern tip of Kangwa Island, you can look across the channel to North Korea, barely a mile away, this morning made even more mysterious and inaccessible by a low mist that settled on the hills and water. It's a place where Korea confronts its past. For much of Cohen's writing career, even to speak of reunification could be an offence under the national security laws, evidence of pro-communist sympathies. Yet it's an unhealed wound that Cohen addresses in his poems. The legacy of the pain of partition and a yearning to make the culture whole again.
The battle line became the blood-stained armistice line. Guns barrel to barrel, the barbed wire became a wall dividing us as enemies, became a fence inside of which we got used to living. We no longer knew that we were two, no longer knew we were each only half.
That sense of finding a voice collectively for people and not just the poet's own voice has led you into a very public position on many, many difficult issues in Korea. It's brought you into conflict with the government, for instance. Your desire that you've described for a kind of unity between North and South, that seemed often in the past to be very politically controversial, and you've been punished for that.
I write not just of the South, but the whole Korean peninsula. Now we are divided, but through literature, reconciliation could happen. I want communion, empathy with everybody and every place.
You said that poetry is obliged to be faithful to its public function in the world.
Today, we don't know what poetry is for. Poetry is spoken in the first person, I, but that I is every culture, every person. I write for the I that is all of us. I cannot exist by myself. My mission is to bring poetry back to life in the world. The one people we have to create is not a matter of going back, nostalgic for the past. It's a matter of gathering and establishing a completely new people. Unification must be the dazzling creation of an afterwards, not what went before.
The last time I meet him, it's at a table carousing with a gathering of fellow poets. At 80, he retains the energy of a force of nature.
Civilization doesn't go on getting better and better. Like a snake that twists on itself into a figure eight, it'll bite its own tail. The digital age is a process, a period in the ongoing cycle of life. I'm a capitalist too, but one who wants to keep his eyes open. I want to live life to the extreme. Only when your will is weak do we get old. I want to die with a glass of wine in my hand. I want to die standing up.
Monk, drunken drifter, dissident, survivor, and always a poet, merging his life and his times. What I want, he says, is to become the poem that's at the poet's end. Not a poet, but a poem. Andrew Motion.
He is the great poet of his own country of the last several generations, actually. I mean, partly because he summarises in his poems so much of what's been important about the extraordinary development of that extraordinary and fascinating country. And also because we're dealing with poems which travel very well. What it is like to live in time, that's something we all ought to be interested in. It's urgently needed for there to be a broader collection of Cohen's poems, and we will see that we've been living at the same time as one of the master poets of the world.
You've been listening to Ko Un, the People's Poet of Korea. I'm Mike Greenwood, and the producer was Eve Streeter. It was a Peer production for BBC World Service.